This is the New Nationalist Perspective with Dr. Tom Sunek, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Dr. Tomislav Sunek is a former professor, author, translator, and diplomat. Visit his website for interviews, essays, books, and more at tomsunek.info. And now here's your host, Tom Sunek.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, dear friends. This is Tom Sunek, your host. And I'm broadcasting today from Croatia. And I'm very, very pleased to have a very special guest on my show. Some of you may have heard of him. Some of you may have heard of his about his books. Some of you may have met him. This is Bob Whitaker. Bob, thanks for being with me, and thanks for coming to my show.
Oh, yeah. Glad to, Tom.
How's everything, Bob? May I ask you where you're at right now?
Ask what? Where I am?
Yes, where are you at? I know that you're in the States, but where specifically you are right now, because I'm way, way, way away from you.
It's Columbia, South Carolina.
Okay. I've always had a particular weakness for the Southerners. You know that in my writings, I've been often making parallels between the Southerners and the antebellum South, and particularly with the unreconstructed South and the events that happened after the end of the war in the South. I often draw the parallels with the events in Europe after 1945. But this is a long story, very complicated stories. But believe it or not, there are quite a few parallels we could talk about. Anyway, Bob, let me ask you a couple of things. I'm sure you're aware of this political correctness, and this is the main reason why I want you today to talk about this on my show. You did specifically write about political correctness in some of your books. And in fact, given the fact that you also worked as a government employee in the Reagan administration, I'd like you to tell me in a few words first, how do you actually trace the genesis of this political correctness? To my understanding, this expression, those words popped up in the public sphere, so to speak, in the early 80s when you were basically in D.C., correct?
That was when it came into American discourse.
Right. That's something I'd like to know. Trace.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bob.
All right. Actually, if you read, I was reading a biography of Stalin, and in the letters there, the term political correctness comes up a good deal in the 1930s. It's really a Marxist term.
Well, what was the... pardon my ignorance, I'm glad to hear that. I know, of course, that there were some similar expressions in communist Yugoslavia for political correctness, but yeah, they're not exactly the carbon copies, lexically speaking.
No, they're not. But the term itself is an ideological term. If you believe that the struggle you are in is a political struggle, then political correctness is part of it.
So let me ask you, what was the Soviet expression, ideological expression for political correctness in the early 30s?
I don't speak Russian, but in the translation, it's political correctness. One fellow was writing to Stalin. He said, "What I am saying is not precisely politically correct."
All right.
Term is not new. It's simply a movement of that sort of thinking, disciplined thinking.
All right. Now, let's just distinguish two points here, Bob. First, there is this lexical issue of political correctness. We are trying actually to dig up exactly when did it pop up in the in the lexicon, in the vocabulary, in Europe, for that matter, in the Soviet Union. And on the other hand, we are looking at the ideological facets of it, and we'll discuss about this pretty much in detail. But the reason I'm asking that, I didn't know, literally, I didn't know that this word existed, rather that expression in the Soviet Union in the early 30s. What I do know, however, in communist Yugoslavia, and possibly I should have probably mentioned it earlier in my shows, in communist Yugoslavia, very, very early on in the 60s and 70s, when I was still a boy, before I immigrated to the States, we used the word which was known, which I'll give you the rough translation, the political fitness, rather. It's probably a lousy translation, it's not the best.
Political what?
Political fitness, or political rectitude, rather. It's a I'll tell you in Croatian, it's how political podobnost, politička podobnost. This was a mantra. This was like the holy word in the vocabulary of communist Yugoslavia. And I'm pretty much certain, given the fact that the Russians speak the same language, that the same expression, politička podobnost, that political fitness, I'm just giving you a rough translation.
Yeah, it's the second word I have, political what?
Podobnost, P-O-D-O-B-N-O-S.
No, I mean in English. What's the second word? Political what?
Political rectitude, I could say. I'm translating into rough English, like political rectitude. So basically, the reason I'm asking you that, because I see you are dealing also with the political discourse, and you did that as a politician. So this is something where I'd like to sound you out. How do you trace that in the Reagan administration? Because the word first appeared, I remember, in the United States of America in the early 80s. Political correctness. Before that, it didn't exist.
It was used at universities in the 1980s. It was certainly not Reaganites. It was simply that people were not... It applied generally to racial thinking. That it was politically correct what you said. They didn't, in other words, at the universities, they didn't say, you have used the wrong word. They say, you have been politically incorrect. Which sounds like something out of the 1930s purge trials.
Okay.
And that's pretty well what it is in a university. It's banned.
Okay. Now, when you were in D.C. in the early 80s, you were in the Reagan administration. Can I ask you specifically, what type of a job did you do back then in the early 80s?
I was with the Office of Personnel Management, which ran the civil service.
Okay. Well, did you hear that expression back then? Because I'm pretty much certain in the lobbies or in the White House or in the State Department that word must have leaked somehow from the colleges, from different universities surrounding the Valley of the Beast, if you wish.
Well, the National Review was attacking the use of the word in the 80s in the universities. It was the first time they had heard of it. And basically, it was just a relaxation where they were using Marxist thinking.
And why is that?
Universities?
Yes, why is that?
Because they think in Marxist terms.
All right, now, why did you, in fact, you must have, okay, let me put it that way. When did you start using yourself in a derogatory fashion, if you wish, that expression, political correctness? I'm sure you must have heard it back in the mid-80s when you were still in D.C.
I heard it then, yeah. And it was a very bad mistake on the part of the liberals. Because it gave them the impression that they really were a bunch of rigid thinkers. And it gave us a word to jump them with. Couldn't use the liberal, but political correctness just has a ring to it of disciplined. You're not allowed. You know, the universities always try to keep up this thing of free speech. And of course, we all knew, I used to be a professor, we all knew that there was a totalitarianism coming on the campuses. A rigid hotel, but they didn't say it. They always talked about free speech and free academia and all that. And when they slipped up and started saying something was not politically correct, it was just the right terminology we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, bad mistake on their part.
Well, let me ask you a little bit provocatively, if I may. What did the Reagan government, or for that matter, what did you yourself do in order to prevent it? Was there any counterculture, counterpower on the part of the Reagan administration? Because I remember back then, I was in the States, there were some real honorable people working there, like Pat Buchanan, whom I knew rather well. In fact, I was pretty much involved in his campaign back then. And I'm quite certain that he was actually a spokesman in his administration. What did they do? What did you do in order to prevent this political correctness from spreading out like a disease? Because nowadays it has become a mantra. We know it's a civic religion. But did you at least attempt to do something to prevent this religion, as you use the word, the mantra, from spreading?
The word itself, as I say, we were happy they were using it.
Why is that?
Because it exposed their rigid thinking. It made it clear that some types of discussion are not free on campuses. And believe it or not, people really have the superstition that there is such a thing as free speech on campuses.
Uh-huh.
And so they were very unhappy with it. I remember they kept making up new origins for those words, for political uh-huh. correctness. And they said, well, it only started and it was a joke. Some of them said it was a joke and so forth. And they make up their own explanations for things. And they tried to say that they really didn't mean that.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the words are concerned, political correctness itself, I've been fighting against all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was instrumental in putting together the combination elected Reagan. I went out in the streets with the workers, you know, demonstrating against busing, certain textbooks. I united them. And I spoke for them free, and I pushed. I wrote a book called "A Plague on Both Your Houses" that was mm-hmm. that was a basis of our side of the coalition. Bill Rusher, William Rusher, sort of handled the other side. He was with the respectable conservatives, as we called them, and mm-hmm. I was the populist, sort of the street mm-hmm. leader. And so that coalition of what they used to call Wallace voters. And Reagan voters are what won the 80 election.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done a little more than my part.
Sure. Well, congratulations. You certainly did a good job, especially with your books. And I didn't even realize until recently that you had some troubles with your latest book, Why Johnny Can't Think. You were apparently trying to bring some books over the border in Canada, and apparently they were seized. And I just can't believe it, you know, literally. It just reminds me literally of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, well, book burning, they always talk about book burning. Liberals always talk about book burning. But the only people who practice it today, if you send a book to Canada that is against political correctness, they take the book, they burn it, and then they charge the person you were sending it to for the process of burning.
That's really scary. Remind me of the Soviet Union. Well, again, back to political correctness, Bob. Well, how do you explain then this deluge, this spreading of this word? I mean, I assume that you retired when? In the late 80s?
Yeah.
Late 80s. And ever since this word popped up on the horizon, not just the word, not just the expression, but the ideological underpinning behind it, it has been spreading out literally like a disease. And basically, we are dealing with this beautiful word that you're using, mantra. Why do you consider that a mantra? Is this like a civic religion or something that we have to abide by, even if we don't, even if we despise it?
Well, I have never seen them use it since the early 80s. It's been entirely used by our side.
Okay, well, that's a good point. So, in other words, we are the ones who are scared, right?
Yeah, we're, we're the ones who are, for once in their miserable little lives, the respectable conservatives, caught on to something and used it. Usually they're very harmless. As soon as they get a hold of something that hurts liberals, you know, really hurts, they back off.
Okay.
But in this case, we really have rammed it down their throats. And if they had their druthers, if they had it the way they wanted it, it would disappear tomorrow.
Let me ask you, Bob, when you were in D.C., in Washington, D.C., in the Reagan administration, I'm sure you witnessed firsthand this gradual erosion of the public discourse. Well, were there, I'm sure, given the fact that you were dealing with that all your life, I'm sure you may have noticed this erosion of this public, for that matter, of this free communication or free speech. Were there any signs that you could have detected early on? Or?
There were signs. There were signs in the 1950s I was talking about. I was 17 years old. I was 16 when I started college, and I was already, I wrote in this debate society, my initial speech was The Dangers of Modern Liberalism. And I talked about how things would not be allowed. So this isn't really new with me.
So basically your assumption or your theory is that, also judging by the books, is that this liberalism inevitably leads by its own dynamics into a new form of soft totalitarianism. Am I correct?
Yes, but most people, if you ask, as you all know, I talked to communists back when the communists were in power, and they would say the Soviet Union had free speech. They said that because in the Soviet Union, you could say anything that you ought to say.
Good point. It reminds me of ex-communist Yugoslavia. I grew up in ex-communist Yugoslavia as a boy. And of course, we also had freedom of speech. And I keep saying that over and over again. Every government which is bombastic, if I can say, about the usage of the word freedom of speech, usually is trying to hide something behind it. So I keep telling my students that they should first, if they want to gauge the level of free speech or freedom of speech in some country, they should first look at the criminal code and not at the Constitution.
Right. If you've ever read, I don't know if you have, the Stalinist Constitution in 1936.
Mm-hmm. I did, as a matter of fact, yes.
It is the most democratic constitution that could be written, including secession, including freedom of speech.
Well, thank you. I'm really pleased that you have mentioned that, Bob, and you've got to repeat this over and over again for our younger audience. Because indeed, and this is not a joke, both in terms of the choice of words and both in terms of the message, the Stalin's Constitution, because this was during his tenure in 1936, just right on the eve of the Great Purges when millions of people perished. This was literally the best constitution on earth because it used this noun, democracy, So I fully agree with you.
In fact, I drive people communists crazy. I used to drive them because I'd say, why is it that every communist border I pass has landmines and barbed wire to keep people in? But that's such a basic question, people don't ask it. I mean, they were talking, if you go into a communist country, you would hear, true freedom. We really have freedom. This is the worker state. And then when you got out of the worker state, there would be the barbed wire. I don't think you had that in Yugoslavia.
But well, in a somewhat softer version, but we did have it as well. Ours was also the best constitution. It was actually the constitution of 1974. But I never looked at the Constitution per se. I looked at the criminal code, which was extremely harsh.
Exactly.
Now, Bob, let me ask you another provocative question, if I may. I guess I'm also a U.S. citizen, and we are all very proud, but sometimes it seems to me that we're very frivolous about our First Amendment. We keep talking about this, we keep boasting, and there's no question about that. We have the First Amendment, and you can say certain things in the United States of America that you cannot even think about saying in Germany or in France today. Well, for that matter, even right now, I'm sure you've heard of David Irving. He's touring the United States of America. He wouldn't even think about it. He wouldn't even hallucinate about the possibility of touring Europe because he would be either arrested or he would be ostracized or he would be beaten. Now, the reason I'm asking you that, how do you square away this First Amendment with this erosion of free speech in the United States of America?
Well, because what you just were talking about, that in most countries you look at the criminal code. In the United States, Stormfront, you know, or any other, quote, racist, unquote, thing would be banned completely. The United States is the only place on earth where one is allowed to be openly white.
I agree, and I certainly, I'm in full agreement with you. But at the same time, well, look at this. Pardon me if I'm not quite correct. You have heard about this new bill about the hate speech, about hate crime, which is, from the lexical perspective, if you look at this hate speech, what the hell does that mean, hate speech? I mean, this is a construct, a verbal construct, which never existed, you know, in the American language or in the democratic language. So again, both on the lexical level and on the ideological level, I see something fishy here. On the one hand, yes, you're right, there is Stormfront, there are millions of groups and millions of tribes doing whatever they want, but at the same time we have this gradual erosion of freedom of speech. You can't get a job nowadays in the State Department, for that matter, or let alone even at some college, you know, unless you are politically correct.
Well, the Supreme Court ruled all the way back in the early 50s that you could not be fired for being a member of the Communist Party, but you could be fired for being a member of the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
So that double standard, the liberals are pushing that double standard all the time. You're right. The only difference is, in America, it hasn't taken complete control yet.
I fully agree with you, and that's true, because I myself, I'll tell you, I feel certainly much more relaxed when I give speeches in the United States of America than when I give speeches, let's say, in France or in Germany. I got to look at my convoluted sentences and use some oxymorons and use some more softer expressions in order not to get into troubles. But at the same time, can you explain me, Bob, can you explain our audience, how does that, I mean, we are talking here about the cleavage. On the one hand, we have the First Amendment, we have the freedom of speech, which is really unparalleled anywhere else in Europe, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world. Yet at the same time, we have the strong counterculture still persistent on campuses, as you are arguing all of your books. They run the Marxist, actually, the crypto-Marxist, they run the show absolutely everywhere. In Hollywood, or for that matter, in the motion pictures, or for that matter, in the discourse, they're everywhere. Well, to me, I mean, you can pontificate about freedom of speech. I can decorate myself with the First Amendment, but the fact of the matter is, I can't pull off a job on a college. And this is true for me right now, precisely because I'm not politically correct.
Yes. The First Amendment doesn't cover what private institutions do. And remember, these people really are trying to get rid of it.
Oh, and can you be a little bit more specific? Which people are you talking about? You're talking generally about the leftists or special groups, or interest groups or pressure groups?
Well, yeah, you would call them, yeah, generally the leftists, the anti-whites, as I call them.
Okay.
And they are fighting, in fact, there's a magazine called This Week, and they had somebody's editorial there talking about America's absolutist approach to the First Amendment.
Okay.
Because it just doesn't apply to certain people. And they were endorsed. Yeah.
Don't go away. Just we'll lead it off here for a while. We'll take a short break, and then I will ask you a question. And I'm sorry, it's going to be a very provocative question. You've got to tell me something about yourself. Why didn't you do something more about that? Don't go away, dear listeners. Stay here. We'll be right back. This is Bob Whitaker and Tom Sunik, and I'm very pleased to have Bob Whitaker as my guest on my show.
We'll be right back with the New Nationalist Perspective. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
This is AP Newsman. President John F. Kennedy's sister, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, died early Tuesday morning at the age of 88. Senator Ted Kennedy says his sister touched the lives of millions. She may have been best known as the founder of the Special Olympics. Senator Arlen Specter is facing some hostile questions about health care reform from wary and frustrated voters in Pennsylvania. The Republican-turned-Democrat was accused of trampling on their constitutional rights in a scene reminiscent of town hall meetings that other lawmakers have held across the country. Officials in Kuwait say they've arrested six Kuwaitis linked to Al-Qaeda. The group allegedly planned to attack the main U.S. base in that country. The Interior Ministry says the suspects gave detailed confessions about plans to bomb Camp Arifjan and several other locations. One person died and dozens were injured Tuesday as two powerful earthquakes struck Asia. The U.S. Geological Survey says a 7.6 magnitude quake hit the Indian Ocean near India's Andaman Islands. Tsunami warnings were issued but later lifted. Ed Donahue, The Associated Press, with AP News Minute.
Let's return to the New Nationalist Perspective with Tom Sunik. Brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, dear friends. This is Tom Sunik and the Voice of Reason, and welcome back to my show, The New Nationalist Perspective, and welcome back to me and to Bob Whitaker. I'm very, very pleased to have this old gentleman with us. I'm sure that you have heard of him, and I'm sure you may have read some of his book, including the last one, Why Johnny Cannot Think. In fact, probably, Bob, we could find another title for this book, Why John cannot read and why he doesn't want to read, because unfortunately we are witnessing, and you describe that very well in your book. We are actually dealing with this zeitgeist, with this ambiance, with this social malaise in the society where people simply don't want to read and where they think that the knowledge can be sort of bought like a merchandise. But anyway, Bob, I was corresponding with you yesterday, and you asked me a few questions, and probably I'd like to ask you for your opinion about racial homogeneity, or probably this is a harsh word, let's use the word ethnic homogeneity in Europe and Eastern Europe. I'm sure that you are aware, probably more than anybody else, that Eastern Europe is certainly, in terms of race, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of whiteness, if you wish, certainly much more European than Western Europe. And that's another irony of history. Due to communism, there was no bait, so to speak. There was no motivation for third world immigrants to settle down in Eastern Europe. And you asked me, How about what is Croatia and how does Croatia look like now? Well, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that once Croatia becomes the member state of the European Union, things will dramatically change.
Yes.
So my question is, do you see, as far as Western Europe and the United States of America is concerned, in terms of those huge demographic changes that have occurred over the last 20 years, do you see a parallel or do you see any difference?
Oh, there's a great deal of difference, but what I would like to get to, if I may, is the fact, as I keep pushing it, some of my points are so basic that people don't see them. Over here, our media talk about, is Eastern Europe ready for immigration yet? Now, nobody asks why someone would ask that question. A sovereign state has the right to decide its own immigration policy normally. If Vietnam were to throw off the communists, the first question would not be, are you ready for immigration yet? Japan, are you ready for immigration?
I was going to ask, because I never heard that expression. Did you hear it? Did you see it in the New York Times, or did you read it in the commentary, or in the foreword, in some journals?
It comes up from time to time.
Okay.
And it isn't a regular theme, but what I'm saying is, when someone brings it up, it's not a question of do you want the third world there. The question is when. Now, for example, in Africa, I've been there a good deal, and there's lots of room where a lot of good Vietnamese farmers would love to have some of that land, and they could feed the Africans. But nobody asks the Africans if they want immigrants.
Exactly, that's a good point. Well, I guess this is...
Well, it's more than a good point. It's a point I have to emphasize. I have to centralize it. Nobody asked Japan or Taiwan if they decide to increase or decrease immigration. It's no problem. But if France or the Netherlands decide to restrict immigration, it suddenly becomes racism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here is the point. The reason people have no difficulty asking about Eastern Europe and immigration, which we're sort of, over here, we're just sort of waiting for you to open the floodgates, as we've been told to do, is because your countries are white.
Mm-hmm.
There is all white countries, and only white countries are supposed to bring in and assimilate with the third world. There are to be no exceptions. And if you want political correctness, that is what it, that's the biggest thing it means. There was one of our people was asked to debate diversity up in Canada. He started up there, and then they said, no, we can't debate diversity in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You can't question it.
Bob, let me ask you a specific question. Let's try to narrow down the topic a little bit, because I'm quite certain our listeners would like to decipher, or let's say they would like to case, so to speak, the foe. Who is or who are the people? Who are those quote-unquote hidden forces or lobbies that are pushing for this wild immigration, not just to Western Europe or Europe at large, but to the United States of America? We are talking about millions, and literally about millions of non-European people, individuals, coming both clandestinely or whatever to our European, Euro-American shores. And I would like to know, do you have some inside information or outside information, as you wish, as to who may be benefiting from it, who actually pushes for this? And I'm asking you a rhetorical question. I'm 100% certain if tomorrow the referendum was held in the United States of America, I'm certain that 90% of white European Americans would denounce, in fact, they would be firmly opposed to foreign wild immigration. Am I correct?
Yes, but the 90% of the population does not have lobbies in Washington.
So which lobby are you specifically targeting?
All right. First of all, let me answer your question.
Sure, go ahead.
Because the Wall Street Journal, which is supposed to be a conservative magazine, and you know what it is, it's the spokesman for Moneyed America, it wants a constitutional amendment which says there are no borders.
Did you read that specifically?
That's the official stand of the Wall Street Journal.
Of the editorial board? Does it say specifically?
Yeah, right.
Thanks for telling me that. I will quote you on that.
Well, I personally, I went to graduate school with the fellow who was for a while the editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. So,
okay, let's go a step further. Let's try to play a little bit of insightfulness. What is the motive of this general board of editors? What may have been the motive to write that down? Why should they be interested in the first place?
You asked me the question. Yeah.
Yes.
The answer is they want labor cheap.
Okay. Okay, here we go. Go ahead. I will ask
you. All right. It's very simple. The big money wants cheap labor. The leftists want leftist votes. There was a book written called, It was called Importing Revolution. And it said that liberals, especially since I was working on this thing because I helped get the working people here in the conservative side, and they were talking about a working class revolution. Mm-hmm. The left was. Then they found that actually the working people here tend toward the conservative side.
Mm-hmm.
So they have decided that they're going to have to import revolution. In other words, you can't get an American. American working people aren't going to, white working people are not going to work, are not going to vote for the left. They finally gave up on it after Reagan got the working class vote. So the next thing this fellow says is they have to import communist votes or Marxist votes or far left votes.
Before we go any further, let's just clarify. You are dealing with two aspects of this wild foreign immigration. Firstly, you mentioned cheap labor. Yeah. But when I'm, for instance, in my lingo, when I think about cheap labor, I immediately think about what? About capitalism and money sharks. And the answer, my answer would lie, well, let's get rid of capitalism, of this savage capitalism, of the quote-unquote, of the religion of the free market. I'm probably sounding provocative, but that's how I read your words.
Well, in the first place, you keep apologizing for being provocative. I've spent my whole life in politics. I'm used to being provoked.
Okay, so go ahead and tell me. Am I correct? I will not be apologizing. I am too apologetic sometimes.
I understand you. Yeah, the problem is that the left is also for massive immigration.
For different purposes.
Yeah.
For cultural and sociological purposes. But when we're talking in terms of money and when we're talking in terms of labor, let me put it that way. If I were a capitalist, if I was a big guy, let's say in Chicago, or if I was even a planner, if you wish, a big guy, a white guy from South Carolina, if I had a cotton field or if I had some orchards or something, I certainly would at least think it would cross my mind to have cheap labor come from Honduras or from Mexico.
Yeah. The problem is, you're reading me right. I was an economics professor, and in my second book, I said something called, I had a section called Societal Property Rights. And that pointed out that all this libertarian business about true capitalism would open the borders. The problem is, it would also close the free market. In other words, the country itself, the people of the country, are what makes for a productive environment. And most people don't take that into account, that a country is safe. The reason that you would require at least triple the interest on a bond that you bought in Mexico to one that you bought in the United States. The reason is America is inhabited by Americans and Mexico is inhabited by Mexicans. This is an economic factor nobody takes into account.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not that, so if you don't think in those terms, if you think in purely economic terms, not political economic terms, it makes all the sense in the world to bring in all the cheap labor. The problem being, labor votes.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, this is what
We Go don't ahead. Have, for example, Christopher Hitchens over here. He's a Marxist leftist, or at least he was. The longer he's here, the less he seems to be. But they have to bring in people. When they have some really leftist stuff where they say, if the bureaucrats run the economy, it will be more efficient, which is what socialism says. An American can't say that because he'd be... Well, they have to bring in somebody with a British accent or something to say some of these things. Do you follow me?
Sure, go ahead. But you still, I'm sorry if I just want to clarify one thing.
Yeah.
And this is that, in my understanding, and this is, by the way, I'm not trying to sound rhetorical, my opinion, and this is my belief, and my conviction, by the way, my views, my philosophical stance, is that capitalism is the main source. This global capitalism with the religion of, as a great French sociologist, what's his name, I forgot, says the theology of the free market actually is the main culprit of in our chaos of those problems, and not so much the Mexican. I personally have nothing against the guy from some Pedro or Sanchez, whatever his name may be. He's actually just following the logic of the free market. He gets he just comes over here because he will do something that I would never believe in, are willing to consider. And I guess this is what I used to, in Economics 101 back in the States, that's the first thing I learned. And it seems to me if we truly want to get rid of this wild immigration and this diversification, or rather the balkanization of West of Europe, or for that matter, the United States of America, we first and foremost have to re-examine our views and our mantras regarding the free market, such as George Wallace and Huey Long did 50, 60 years ago. I'm sure you agree with me.
Well, the only thing I'm saying in terms of the free market is you've got to replace it with something. Which bureaucrats you want to run things?
Well, isn't that an irony of history? Precisely, there was no free market in Eastern Communist Europe. Was nominally a communist Eastern Europe. We didn't get any foreigners from Northern Africa or from Asia like Western Europe did. Isn't that a tremendous irony of history? I'm asking a rhetorical question, but that's the way it is. I mean, one of the reasons I left the States...
Let me answer you.
Please.
All right. The reason that nobody came into Eastern Europe was because life was miserable there.
All right.
For most people. I mean, why do you think they had those barbed wires to keep people in? Every time I went into one of those countries, I had to go across some barbed wire, and the old universal skull and crossbones were there over a piece of ground that had landmines in it. That wasn't to keep us out. That was to keep you in. If you make a country, in other words, the reason that you have no pressure for immigration, had no pressure for immigration, was because nobody wanted to go there.
Yes. Well, that's obvious.
Yeah, but now what you got to do, unless you want to go back to the old system, is to emphasize, see, I'm hitting on this thing about they want every white country not only to immigration but assimilation. In other words, it's entirely, Bob, policy is anti-white.
Bob, yeah. I'm sorry, the subject they, who do you imply by they want assimilation? Who do you refer to by they? Because you would like to narrow down the culprit as much as possible. What do you mean by they? Capitalists, free marketeers, bankers?
Yes.
Are they the bad guys?
And leftists. Everybody who has something, in other words, they believe that the whole world ought to be loyal to some book. It could be Marx's book. It could be Adam Smith's book. They have no room for white people being loyal to white people.
I agree with you as far as our whiteness is concerned, but again, this is a philosophical dilemma that I'm also facing. Do we want to have a nice life, a good life? Do we want to live in this dictatorship of well-being, which implies inevitably the hordes and the swarms of many, many non-European immigrants coming to Europe and the United States of America? Or do we want to have a more frugal and more Spartan way of life and stay ethnically, racially homogenous? I don't know the answer, but I have to ask you. Probably you do know the answer.
Well, we passed in the early 1920s, one of the first victories of organized labor here was the passage of the Immigration and Nationality Act. And if you notice, the United States only allowed in immigrants who were from a percentage countries that Americans were already from.
Mm-hmm.
So we did, in fact, manage to limit immigration under capitalism.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. But again, we're trying to narrow down who are the culprits, who actually brought those, who actually changed the quota of Europeans. I remember when I... Oh, go ahead.
All right. The problem is that no one says what I'm saying, that we should, because of race, because we have a right to have white countries in the world. That's it.
I'm in agreement, Bob. Well, let me ask you.
But socialism, if you want to keep people out, you can use any system you want to make it miserable.
Mm-hmm.
That just doesn't seem like much of a solution. But the question is, are you going to talk about race or not? If you're not going to talk about race, then you're left with a solution of finding some way to make white countries undesirable.
All right. Now, Bob, let me ask you. I'm sure you do have at least some tentative solutions or some proposals, some suggestions as to how we should fend off and fight against changing demographics. Well, I would certainly appreciate, I'm sure our listeners would appreciate hearing from you as to some of your proposals and to some of the suggestions you might have. Because, of course, one thing where I'm very pleased with you, and I'm truly, I don't mean to flatter you, I'm very pleased with your criticism of what you call respectable conservatives. I call them country club conservatives, because I think that they are the problem. They can never solve the problem. And that's where I really, I will tip my hat and I will give you extra credit for it. But what are your suggestions as to how we can actually retrieve our heritage and yet at the same time keep our standard of living pretty much as it is?
Well, I would be perfectly willing to give up our standard of living to save the race. But the question is, why do we have that choice? I think we should use the word genocide more.
That can you explain
the whole,
to that?
All right. The whole program of, right now, as we all know, everybody knows it, they just don't face it, that the every white country in the world, if you ask the news media or anybody else, is supposed to have immigration and assimilation.
Okay.
Japan is not supposed to.
Yes.
It's entirely a matter of race. But most people don't think of that. What I'm saying is you have to say it, and you have to say it again and again and again, because that is the truth that is most completely suppressed. You cannot question diversity, as they call it, in any country but the United States. And if we keep ignoring this point, a very simple point, they're going to be able to keep us from saying it.
Yeah, Bob, before we wrap it up, give me a couple of suggestions as to what we have to do, particularly the younger audience, or the younger students for that matter, my colleagues, my friends. What do we have to do to bring this issue of race in order to preserve our heritage?
Call it genocide.
Okay. So basically
stop talking about it's not race or that you're being open-minded or anything like that. Keep repeating that integration and immigration, third world immigration, is only required of white countries.
Okay.
Every white country on earth has to bring in large numbers of people from the third world and assimilate with them. This is genocide. The minute you get off of that, then you're going to lose. Mm-hmm. We have to hammer this. Now, this sounds, I know this is monomaniacal, but it's also the truth. Somebody's going to say, well, if this is genocide, then why do you talk about other things? Hammer it in?
Okay. Bob, well, thank you very much. I guess my understanding is, let me put it in my own words, we just have to hammer it in with the younger audience. Let's be proud of who we are, and let's just fight against this self-induced genocide, and let's write to our representatives, our congressmen, and let's, you know, keep America as it was supposed to be from the, as it was designed by the founding fathers.
And Croatia.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Bob. I guess we're on the same page, as we say, and I'm very, very pleased. Well, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, thank you very much for being with me, and I was very honored and pleased to have Bob Whitaker with me online. And thank you very much once again, and thanks to our technical engineers who are monitoring this program. And good night. Bye now.
Thanks for listening. The New Nationalist Perspective with Tom Sunick will return next Tuesday from 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.